Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
British composer Christopher Barnett is known for his versatility and dynamic compositions in his work in cinema and television. His experience in scoring documentaries and film is noteworthy, with his compositions being featured in Getting Away with Murders, Postcards from the 48%, The First Film, Johanna, Modern British Slavery, All the Wild Horses, A Dose of Happiness, Borrowed Time, 3-Minute Moments, A Cock and Bull Story, and Spear Goes to Hollywood. He has composed music for theatre, concerts, academia, and corporate campaigns for organizations such as the WIFS Foundation International Visionary Awards, Amnesty International, London Eye, Madame Tussauds, and Canon. In 2020, his contemporary classical piece, Crepe Soule, was amongst the featured music released on a double album of Air Adele's esteemed worldwide roster of composers and artists in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which benefits the musical charity Breathe Arts Research. Christopher holds an MMUS from the London College of Music and a BMUS from Roehampton Institute, where he composed and performed classical music, jazz, Balinese gamelan, Caribbean steel pans, and the music, culture, and spirituality of the Zimbabwe, Shona, and Native America. Christopher has professional voting memberships that include BAFTA, PRS, the Ivors Academy, and World Soundtrack Academy. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Christopher Barnett. Where do we find you in the world, and how are you doing?
First of all, I'm fine, I'm very well. I'm based in London, UK, and it's very cold and very grey here today, sadly.
Okay, let's rewind. At what age did you think, cool, you want to be in the music or entertainment world, creative world, and how did that journey progress to where we are currently?
Oh, that's an interesting question. If I'm really honest, that question never occurred to me. I mean, I come from a Jamaican family. To have a career in the arts was never really an option. You know, it was, we were quite strapped for, it was a very humble abode. You know, we were a humble family, and my mother was the driving force in my life, and really had different aspirations, you know, get a good career in something sensible like engineering or medicine or what have you. So, I mean, I played the drums when I was 11 years old at school, and sang in the choir. But really, it was really for fun. Having said that, my love of music has always been very, very deep. So, you know, in my early teens, I DJed in certain clubs and organized my own parties for the other kids and that kind of thing. And then when I left school, I went into engineering. So I became a mechanical engineer, got an apprenticeship doing that. So we built boilers and for power stations, and I traveled around the country and that kind of thing. But in the evenings, I would still go to recording studios and shadow a record producer, Michael Riley from Steel Pulse. And I would learn about the desk and, you know, how to produce and watch how he interacted with the string players and these sorts of things. So for me, it was really a love of music. And it never really occurred to me that I could have a career in music up until that time. Certainly not film composing, you know. Yeah, I think that when I was in engineering, I was stationed in an office with a chap who was a singer, and he was actually releasing stuff. And through our conversations, it was like, hang on a minute. And he was a black fella as well, so like myself. So it's like, oh, okay, so that's possible. So how do you do it? And that kind of got my juices flowing and my brain sparking, you know. My hero was always Quincy Jones, still is. And so I felt maybe there's an opportunity to become a British Quincy Jones, record producing and that kind of stuff. And that kind of set me on a journey. I began writing songs and producing stuff just, for myself. And then when my engineering career hit the skids, there was a recession and work dried up. I thought, well, if I'm going to be a poor or anything, I might as well be a poor musician. So then I embarked on 6 years of study. So up until that time, I was all self-taught. So I learned jazz, played jazz piano, learned how to compose jazz, classical music. I went to university, did the degree in classical music and world music. So I played gamelan and steel pans and all these, African Shona drumming and that kind of stuff. Native American music, which I went to America and had a chance there to learn with a Native American. And then when I came back, I thought, well, now what do I do now? Because I have all this knowledge and certain pianistic skills, play jazz, bit of jazz, or running a jazz group. I thought, what do I do with all this stuff? So I thought, I know, I'll do a master's in film and TV composition, and maybe that will help me to kind of consolidate all this stuff that I'd done. So I did a year's postgrad in that, and then it was okay, now I'm going to try and make a career of this. And at that time, I mean, when I started formally at study, I was already in my early 20s. So I kind of studied as an adult learner, and was always the worst student in the classroom because I had to catch up. But when you're humble and desperate to learn and hungry to learn, that kind of is a good motivator,
You finished your master's, and then what was the first project that you worked on after that? And how did the next steps happen that you were able to maintain and sustain a career in music composition for movies and television?
When I was coming to the end of my master's degree, at the time, I think the internet was in its very early stages. I think this was like, late 90s or early 2000s, but late 90s. And at the time, people were saying to me, it's impossible to kind of come out of, study education and then walk straight into a job, a feature film or what have you is. But I was very fortunate. I when I finished, I just, kind of just threw myself into trying to network with filmmakers, short film makers and that kind of stuff. And I think this is where my mechanical engineering side really helped, because I was used to communicating with people on a certain level and coming across in a professional way. I managed to bag myself an Albanian comedy called Aventuret I Baba Dimni, which means The Adventures of Father Christmas. And it was the only as far as I know, the only Albanian comedy made, especially at that time, because they'd just come out of their war, the civil war, and everything was kind of all their films were all kind of war based. So this was a light-hearted take on Father Christmas, who goes and travels and meets Little Red Riding Hood and Sleeping Beauty and all these characters. But it was a feature film, and it was also, a nice opportunity for me to really stretch my legs and really find out what I could do as a composer, because one scene was jazz saxophone, sexy Red Riding Hood, and then the very next scene it was something much more kind of serious but comedic, classical kind of thing. So I was able to write in several different styles in one movie. It was a low budget independent thing. So yeah, so it was very good education just doing that film. And I think obviously, when you're studying, the things that you learn are very, very different to when you're actually working in the real world on a film. The things that you need to know is kind of a bit night and day. So that's where I really learned, got my chops together in scoring films,
Why do you say that? Is that because when you're studying, it's mainly theory, and then when you get out of that, it's mainly practical? Or let's unpack that further.
Yeah, I think it's there's an element of practical in the study as well, because we wrote for ensembles, and I worked with musicians, classical musicians for the first time. Prior to that, it was jazz musicians. But I think when you're working on a film, you're dealing with people who are non-musical, and
Oh.
you have deadlines. It's all about the communication and what they understand. And what I understand from what they're telling me, and vice versa, So I know they're Albanian as well. So a difference in understanding certain things, certain terms, huge learning curve, huge. But it was really successful, and the director and the producers and the actors are they're my friends to this day. Some 25 years later.
So this is just a thought process that I'm throwing out there. So maybe it was a good thing that your first project was in a different language, because then it taught you those communication skills, the steep learning curve, etc., head on, compared to if your first project was in English. This allowed you then to dive deeper in the pool, so to speak, and swim further. Your thoughts?
Definitely, definitely. And as I was saying before, I was kind of used to being the worst person in the room when I started studying, sort of early 90s, mid 90s. So there's a humility there. I'm just kind of soaking it up, keeping my ears open, listening as much as I can and doing as much as I can to move the film forward. So it was good.
You've done composition for documentaries and for sort of fictional films. So, what is the difference between your approach when composing for a documentary or fictional film, or is it the same?
It's a very similar approach, but with documentaries, we are aware that, with the music, we are dealing with someone's life, real life, real events. So with film, it's usually, film is fictional, and so we can make things bigger and kind of more spectacular. With a documentary, you can't really do that. So we're aware that we have to kind of treat what the subject matter with a, what's the word, what's the best word, some element of respect, so you don't want to go too big, or make it, yeah, just too big when it's not appropriate. It's a bit like going to a funeral, in a dance suit or what have you. You kind of want to attend the thing in the with the right frame of mind. So that's essentially the difference. But otherwise, there are many similarities. We approach the technical side of it in a similar way, and also with the research and that kind of thing.
For the listeners who are unaware, what is film composition? What does it mean?
To most people, film composition is some kind of action music, da da da, da. But film composition for me is placing. So we have a picture, we have a moving picture, we have a film, a documentary, and the music, we're infusing the film with its spirit, its soul. So when you hear the score, you understand the tone of the film right from the beginning. From the first notes, I know what type of film this is going to be. This is going to be a romance, or it's going to be drama, or something which is a bit like a horror, or whatever it is. And the key with what I do is to try to infuse the picture with something that the viewer cannot see. or maybe the actor isn't kind of isn't perhaps getting over in his in their performances, and so we try to put something there which is not so not too obvious. You know, we don't want to mirror what we're seeing on screen, but we want to enhance the story. It's a very challenging thing, or can be.
As a film composer, at what point do you come into the process of being in the creative part in the film? Are you in the discussion phases? Are you at the end once the film's been edited? So, what point are you part of the process and creating for the actual project?
Well, that varies. It depends
Okay.
on who I'm working with. So if I'm working with directors who I've worked with before and we have a regular rapport, I mean, there's a couple that I'm working with at the moment and, you know, we've done stuff before. Usually I come on with one in particular, I come on very early and his name's David Wilkinson, and he sends me stuff throughout the process, even while he's raising the budget and that kind of stuff. And we have discussions about what the music might be for certain things. He's a friend, so we, you know, it's like having a friendly conversation. And then when the film's done, then I get started formally. For the most part, with directors that I haven't worked with before, I'm usually probably the last person on the project.
Okay.
And then, you know, everything is more or less filmed, and then we have a discussion about music. We'll do some the spotting, which means we sit through the film and decide where music should be and how long it should be and what character emotion, what emotion the music should follow, these things. If I come on, when I'm coming on very late, sometimes we have what's called a temp track laid onto the film. So the director and the editor have laid on this music, which kind of dictates what they're looking for. And that can be a help or a hindrance depending on how attached they become to those pieces of music, if you know what I mean. Because the worst thing for a composer is having to mimic or pastiche stuff that's already there. You know, it's like, well, just, you know, why don't you just license that music? Obviously, they don't have the budget for it, but you know.
Okay, so I understand now why they don't license their music because of budgets. That makes sense. How much percentage of a documentary or of a movie is music? So, excluding that beginning credits and end credits, the actual talking section for documentaries and movies, is there actual sort of a structure in the film world that says, okay, 55% of the documentary is music or has music in the background, 70% for movies? Or does it vary? Can you explain this for us?
It varies typically. I mean, I did an independent Indonesian movie over Christmas called Johanna. And I think that was like, I think 15 minutes, 20 minutes of music, all percussion based. But typically it can be anything for an hour onwards. So, you know, I've done many films where it's over an hour, 60 minutes of music. You know, maybe for a 120-minute film, you know. So I would kind of lean towards what percentage is that? Is that like 80%, you know, 75%, typically speaking.
So we recognize that you come in at different points and different productions, the beginning, middle, or end, dependent on your relationship with the director. But from the point of actually starting the composition for the movies, for the actual element, how long does that take? Is it 2 days? We think, oh, it's easy, it's just quick, it's a couple of days. But how long does that process actually take in creating the compositions for the film or the documentary?
Ideally, we want at least, I would say at least 6 weeks
Oh,
of
wow. Okay.
time to do that. You know, I mean, it's still fairly quick. But the real answer, I guess, it depends on the style of the music. You know, if it's action based and the tempos are really, really quickly, then really, really quick, then it means that, you know, we're going to write less music in less, you know, it's going to take longer to write that kind of music because, you know, it's moving at such a pace, you know.
Okay.
If it's dare I say, drony a drony score, where you're kind of using pads and those sorts of things, then that can be done fairly quickly. But again, it just depends on the style of the music, really, and the movie itself, and also if I mix in, say, in 5.1 or Dolby Atmos, then availability of studios locally to us, because there's not a lot many studios have actually closed down here in London the last few years. So these things can add to the timeline, of scoring the movie. Yeah, it can be very stressful when you're trying to hit a deadline and there's no availability, and the directors and is stressed and I'm stressed and everyone's stressed. So it's like, yeah, these are the things that we have to pay attention to.
Why have a lot of the studios closed down?
I don't know. I think it's one of those. It's one of those worldwide phenomenons where you have developers and they see a building and they just want to revamp it and sell it on and sell it for housing and that kind of stuff. And this, we've had some tough times in the last few years. So I guess for those owners, it makes sense, to sell on.
Obviously, previous to computers, it was 100% humans creating the music, using the instruments to create the music. These days, with computers, how much percentage of it is it actually humans creating the music compared to the computer creating the music for the production?
Yeah, great question. Well, we're going through a period now where we have the risk of AI coming, and that's a huge concern for us in the music business. It's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, we all, I think most of us use technology in creating our scores. I mean, I work with a program called Logic and Pro Tools. And I use sample libraries and stuff, but I still work with musicians. So once I've created the score, the director has approved it, then I'll go and get as much recorded live as I can for within the budget. I think for many young composers coming up now, that's not really so much of an option for whatever reason, but usually through budgets and maybe experience. But now with the added thing with this AI is that the risk is that the AI will do more and more in terms of composing music. Directors who are kind of strapped for cash might see the AI as an easy way to get a score, whether that score works or not. And so we find ourselves more and more out of work, But this is a problem for all the industries, I think, especially in film and TV and the arts,
Now, I'm talking specifically to musicians who do film and television composition. Would the agreements that came from the strikes in Hollywood last year not also cover the musicians for film and television, or was it only the actors that are covered and not really the musicians for film and television production that came from the agreements from the strike?
Well, in terms of what I do, we have no formal union. We have the Ivors Academy, which negotiates and fights for the rights of composers in this country, but it's not really a formal union, so we don't have the power to strike or anything like that. I mean, if we're working on US-based projects, then maybe there's some crossover where we can benefit from that, but I think for the whole, we are quite separate.
I know in your guys' world, everything's top secretive, and you can't speak about any of it. But what you can speak of, what's next? What's coming up next? Long term, short term, long term? Tell us.
Well, for the future, there's a documentary called The Marbles. From my long-term time collaborator, David Wilkinson, and it's about the Greek friezes, the marbles, which are housed in the British Museum. which refuses to hand them back to the Greeks. So the Greeks wants them repatriated, and there's a big political thing going on as we speak about that. So he's filming that as we speak. I'm just finishing off a lovely little short film called The Fight, directed by Anthony Petrou, which stars his young daughter, his 12-year-old daughter, who's a boxer.
Okay.
And she's has donated her hair for a charity. So that's all part of the movie. She boxes and cuts her hair so that she can fight with the boys. And I'm kind of developing a personal project about British imperialism using music. So that's in the works as well. I'm releasing an album called Profundum, which we released once it's been mixed, which is currently being done now.
Is that an instrumental album or are you actually singing on it?
It's an instrumental album.
Okay.
And it's in honor of some really close people that I lost a couple of years ago. At the time, I was working on a feature film and a documentary and didn't really have time to, understand the grieving process, because I was so intent on getting these things finished. Once it finished, even while I was working, I would experience these different emotions and thoughts and, you know, kind of at the most inappropriate times, like, not now, I've got to focus, you know. So when I finished, I thought, okay, how can I document these feelings and, you know, kind of get something out, expunge myself? So I just started writing some pieces of music, and it became, so far, it's six tracks. And I've, you know, been very lucky to work with some really special musicians. They've, you know, dedicated themselves to their individual tracks. And so I'm treating each piece as a duet between myself on the piano and the other instrument. And the feedback so far has been really, really lovely. So I'm looking forward to releasing that.
I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 years, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite, I'm saying top of mind. But if you had to push play to five songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those five songs be and by whom?
Okay, so it's good that you said they're not favorites, because that would be very hard. But what comes to mind is the first one is Natural Mystic by Bob Marley, which has a really seductive bass entry. Peggy Lee, Is That All There Is? Which is a very nice song. Just reminds you to keep everything in perspective. Stevie Wonder, Till You Come Back to Me. So not the Aretha Franklin version, Stevie Wonder version. Fourth is a piece called Robert Portrait by Quincy Jones. I think that's on his Quintessence album, Big Band Jazz. And the last one is Herbie Hancock, Edith and the Kingpin. Which is a Joni Mitchell song sung by Tina Turner, and it's wonderful.
So I'm that guy that's normally standing up right in front, dancing, jamming, doing my thing. I'll take my phone out and take a couple of videos, a couple of photos, and I'll put it away. I notice that the people around me, they oftentimes 70, 80%, 90% of the time videoing, posting, tweeting, photoing. Do you feel that takes away from the energy of the interaction with the audience and from them being in the moment, or it's just where society is at this stage?
One of the things that we're losing is the ability to just be and enjoy the moment. And whilst it's nice that people want to capture the moment for prosperity, I think we lose something when we don't just put the phone away and take in the performance, the atmosphere, the energy. You know, you wouldn't do that if you went to the theater, although I've seen people do that in the theater.
Yeah.
You know, so it's one of those things where we just have to be active all the time. And I think it's a shame, really. You know, I would also say, you know, it'd be nice if people could go back and just buy a record, rebuy a record player and buy some vinyl and just enjoy, put the vinyl on, put the album on and just sit and enjoy the music just for the sake of enjoying it rather than doing 20 million things at the same time. You know, just be.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message, what would you like to say?
Thanks for the chat. It's wonderful to speak to you, Barrett, and thank you all for listening. I hope you get to check out my work, and especially my upcoming album. Bless you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.